John Rappaport has worked as an investigative reporter for 20 years. He's the author of 5 books. He's written on medical fraud, deep politics, health issues for newspapers and magazines in the U.S. and Europe, including CBS, Health Watch, Spin, Stern, and L.A. Weekly. The L.A. Weekly placed John's name in nomination for a Pulitzer Prize for his interview with the president of Salvador University, where a military takeover had occurred. He is my guest tonight, and what you are going to hear tonight could very well disturb you, but it's information that you need to know, and John is going to bring it to us. John, how are you? How are you feeling these days? You all right?
Feeling good. It's great to be here, George.
Good. My pleasure, too. There are so many things that revolve this topic tonight that I want to talk with you about, including, are there cures for diseases that they're holding back on? Why are drug prices so ridiculously high in the United States? And you can go to Canada or some other country and get it at bargain basement prices compared to what we pay for. And just so many other things that are going on. But more importantly, just to start, John, this whole issue for you has been pretty close because you have done a lot of homework in this arena. What got you so fascinated, or should I even say interested, in covering this?
You know, I was thinking about that today, Georgia, where it all began. And I guess in the early 1980s, when people were talking about AIDS, and I decided, you know, as a reporter, I was doing some stories for the LA Weekly, that I might look into this and see. You know, that just sounded to me like there was something strange about it, like the truth wasn't really being reported. And so I began to look into this, and before long I found a small coterie of very distinguished biologists who said that HIV, which was the germ that they just said was the cause of AIDS, had nothing to do with anything. And I thought, well, that's an interesting story. I mean, you know, what could be more explosive than a charge like that? And so I began to interview these scientists who said that Robert Gallo had announced essentially the wrong virus, or it wasn't a virus at all. And that got me way into the whole, what I can only call the ritual.
Mm-hmm.
Of medical research and how it's done, and when they say, aha, we found a new disease and a new virus, and when they don't, and how much money is being made on the back end from the drugs that they then sell to kill the virus. And so I think that was, you know, the opening salvo for me. That was somewhere in the mid-1980s. And soon after that, I met a doctor by chance in Washington, D.C., who had set up some kind of a treatment center in Uganda for AIDS patients. And I forget what I was talking to him about, but mm-hmm. he said, you know, we found out something really strange in our little treatment center. First of all, we found that we couldn't give any drugs to these people because the drugs didn't have any effect because they were too malnourished. And so what we did was we started a little farm. We grew soy products. These people could make a little bit of money. They
mm-hmm.
could also eat some protein.
Yep, yep.
We got them into that position. He said, at which point we discovered that all their symptoms, their so-called AIDS symptoms, completely disappeared. They totally regained their health. And they had no more problems. I said, do you have any idea of the scope of what you're talking about here? And curiously enough, he didn't really seem to get the message. And I pointed out to him, I said, you know, what you're really saying to me, and this is confirmed by my own research and investigation with other people, is that the people that they're saying are dying of AIDS in Africa and other countries, so-called developing countries, are dying of starvation. They're dying of contaminated water. They're dying of all the problems that they've been dying of for decades and even centuries.
Mm-hmm. Unhygienic, everything you can imagine.
Overcrowding, sewage being pumped directly into the drinking water, you know, all that kind of thing. And, you know, I suddenly felt a little bit like Archimedes. I mean, you know, give me a place to stand with a lever and the world can be moved.
Sure.
This was a whole revelation to me that something was completely backwards in the way that we were looking at these degenerative diseases and the pharmaceutical cartel and the drugs and the research and all that.
Well, did you start to think, though, that we were looking at these diseases in a different way for monetary reasons or because we were just wrong in our approach?
Both. The researchers, the conventional medical researchers, as far as I could tell, and I spoke with many of them, were completely brainwashed by their own training. Any time that, you know, there was even the slightest hint that there might be a new illness or an epidemic or a breakout, they were looking for a new virus. You know, almost before the ink was dry on the facts, they automatically assumed that they had to be looking for a virus. And if you suggested to them that something as simple as, you know, starvation over a period of 100 generations could cause some, you know, they'd say, that's a public health problem. We're talking about something much more specific. At the other end of the spectrum, though, the pharmaceutical companies were looking at these as markets.
Yes.
This is a market. This is the AIDS market, the cancer market,
mm-hmm.
the heart disease market.
The cholesterol market,
the
whatever
it is. The cholesterol market, the arthritis market. And these are, you know, we project that so many billions of dollars worth of drugs can be sold into these markets. And I began reading the prospectuses of these drug companies, and I mean, I thought I was on Mars. You know, the language was so naked. It was all about opportunity, exploitation, money, drugs, and profit.
Was there anything in there about caring?
Not really.
No.
You know, I mean, if you talk to the PR people at the companies, they would talk that talk about how much humanitarian effort was going into all of this. But from what I could see, and I mean, my viewpoint has matured much more, but right from the beginning in the mid-80s, I felt like I was looking at, you know, a greed machine.
But you're not saying, though, that all medicines, all drugs are not useful.
No, I think I can clarify this by saying that medical technology is stunning in its successes when it comes to acute crisis, trauma, emergency medicine. To bail somebody out of a situation which is really life-threatening at that moment and disastrous. And there are certain drugs that can be used
mm-hmm.
short-term for that purpose. But when it comes to the long-term, and now we're talking about billions and hundreds of billions of dollars, I mean, the United States is now spending somewhere around $1.5 trillion a year on healthcare. I mean, it's, 20% possibly of the budget, the federal budget. And the United States ranks in a recent survey of 13 so-called industrialized nations, 12th.
And this new Medicare bill, which was passed, which in some respects may have some benefits for all Americans, but it has one thing in here which I don't understand, and where Congress dropped the proposal that all of us would have liked, which would have made it easier for all of us to re-import, for example, U.S. manufactured drugs from, let's say, Canada or other Western countries where they sell there at dramatically lower prices.
Yeah, well, that was the effect of the pharmaceutical companies pressuring Congress,
yeah.
Obviously. But to answer your question, for the short term, I believe that there are, you know, a relatively small handful of pharmaceutical drugs that do good work on emergency crisis bases. But other than that, you are talking about boondoggles of the most extreme magnitude. I mean, for example, if we went into chemotherapy,
mm-hmm.
we are looking at drugs that are so exceedingly toxic that I have statements from doctors who say that the majority of cancer patients in the U.S. are dying from chemotherapy. That's what they're really dying of. And doctors know this. There has been research done on it. Studies have been published about the overall fantastic failure of chemotherapy. And not only that, but coming right alongside of that are treatments for cancer over the last, let's say, 100 years, and I'm just talking now about the United States and Canada, that have been suppressed. I mean, they have been squashed. We're not just talking about ignored. We're talking about active suppression from the AMA, from the FDA, treatments that were so promising, developed for the most part by individual doctors working on their own outside the hallowed halls of establishment labs, showed such spectacular early results that if any of these treatments had been developed, say, within the National Cancer Institute, people would be dancing in the halls and drinking champagne.
Yeah, exactly.
They just squashed these things. Doctors left the country. They were put on trial for saving people's lives.
They need to keep the cash flow going, don't they?
Exactly. You know, it's a threat. It's a dire threat to the industry, in this case, let's say, of cancer. A dire threat. If somebody comes up with a treatment that really works and all of a sudden all of chemotherapy is off the table and is no longer, everybody has to admit that it's, you know, a Neanderthal effort to solve cancer. I mean, hundreds of billions of dollars just went down the drain. And so for the last 100 years, whenever somebody's poked his head up above board with something that really looks good, it has been totally suppressed by these elements of the medical cartel. We're talking homicide here.
You're talking criminality too, aren't you?
Yeah, we're talking RICO murder on a broad scale.
I want to chat with you for a moment about this push now for vaccinations for a moment, John. As you've heard on the program, I do not take the flu vaccination. I'm not telling people, again, that they should or should not, but I don't. And that's my decision. That's my choice. I haven't had the flu in as long as I can remember as an adult. They're pushing what they say will be one of the worst flus that already appears to be killing more than past flus have in a long, long time. And I'm doing some numbers here today, and I'm saying, okay, we've got 300 million Americans. Let's say 50 million Americans, one-sixth, goes out and gets this vaccination. Not for this new strain, because they don't have a vaccination yet, but gets a flu shot. And I think they're like $10 a piece, right, the vaccine? If I remember, shots are around $10 for the flu. Yeah, I could be off by a couple bucks. But you're talking about $500 million in new sales just this year, just to keep things going.
Overnight. Yeah, it's like you and I get together and we say, gee, is there some way we can make $500 million in the next 6 months? And we say, oh, yeah. I mean, are we going to do it? If we don't have any ethics, we're going to do it. I mean, I completely agree with you about vaccines I'm actually sitting here staggered by your statement about, you know, not taking the flu vaccine, simply because the idea that somebody who hosts a radio show with as many listeners as you have is going to be upfront about that,
Yep.
Oof,
that's me.
It's a chill. It's a great chill and a thrill to hear that because, one of my major areas of research over the last 15 years or so has been vaccines. And the more that I look into this, the more complex the scams and the cover stories and the lies become. And I've been printing, you know, material for a long time, and I have several stories up now on my site about the scam behind vaccines, and for example, the fact that we now have estimates that 1 in 300 children in the United States has autism, 1 out of every 300, and the rate is escalating like crazy, And we know that since the mid-1980s, this has been the case, along with the fact that the Centers for Disease Control has endorsed now about 40 doses of vaccines for every child in the United States today.
I remember back in the 50s, and I was born then in that period, I was given the polio vaccination, and I think they think that that was done with some tainted monkeys.
Yes.
And so that could be in my system, I think.
SV40, yeah. It's a monkey virus, right? We've got mercury. I mean, this is where it becomes, you know, so obvious. Mercury has been in all of these vaccines in a form called thimerosal.
Right.
Okay, now when you start to say, okay, the little babies and the little tiny kids are not going to just get 5 doses of vaccines anymore. They're going to get 40 doses by the time they start going to school. And everybody admits that mercury is a known neurotoxin. There have been estimates that these children who have now been getting so many vaccines have exceeded the allowable mercury rate by 125 times the limit set by the Environmental Protection Agency. Nobody is doing anything about it up to the point of about 2 years ago when the outcry became so great that the CDC said that they were going to order the companies to take out the mercury, but nobody was going to be prosecuted. Well, I happen to know that in February of 2000, a doctor named Thomas Verstraten did a study for the CDC and said, yeah, this mercury could be a very serious brain problem, and a meeting of the CDC was called several months after that. Everybody was in an uproar. And I've got some quotes from people at that meeting. You know, CDC people saying, I don't want to have my grandson get any one of these vaccines.
CDC people saying
yeah,
that.
Yeah, saying this.
The same people who recommend Americans take it.
Exactly. In the same conversation at this meeting on June 8th, 2000, the CDC officials agreed to keep this study private. And here's a quote from Bob Chen, who is the head of the CDC Vaccine Safety and Development Unit. He said, "We have been privileged so far, get this language, that given the sensitivity of information, we have been able to keep it out of, let's say, less responsible hands." Meaning, of course, it's our secret. And indeed, Dr. Roger Bernier, at the same meeting, Associate Director for Science at the CDC, said, I think if we'll all just consider this to be embargoed information.
Embargoed information. Stay with us, John.
Attributed to the public.
John Rappaport, my guest. You hear just some of the things we're talking about. More to come on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie along with John Rappaport. Anyway, John, we're talking about so many things, but let's talk a little bit more about the vaccines before I ask you about what you think one of the biggest stories of the last several years might be and how it was missed. But, you know, we are talking about creating industries. Whenever they talk about a new vaccine needed for a new flu epidemic, all of a sudden, you get people running to the wherever they go to get these shots, and you're talking about $500 million easy. Now, that's not to say that there's not a real flu out there, that there's not problems. I mean, we've heard that 5 or 6 people have already died in Colorado, 1 in Arizona. That's a real case. So what do we do? How do you fight the fact of the fear of coming down with the flu, one, with the possibilities of, well, you know, do you just sit back and fight it out naturally? What do you do?
Well, I'll tell you what my opinion on it is, and that is you don't succumb to the fear. In other words, the way the game is being played is we make you afraid, and then we give you the solution. And we say this is the only sane thing to do, and you are crazy and all sorts of other things if you don't take our solution, which is the vaccine. First of all, as you know from our past conversations, I'm always very suspicious whenever they announce that they have found a new, quote, new disease or a new strain of a disease. I mean, has there ever been an announcement out of Beijing or out of Hong Kong that the Cincinnati flu, you know, was arriving that autumn and that everybody had to get shot up with some kind of a vaccine?
Never.
I mean, you would think.
Never.
That in the history of the world, you know, at some point. But no, it's always coming. I mean, the Fujian, it took me 15 minutes on the internet to figure out what they were talking about with this new Fujian flu. I mean, at first I thought it was Fiji, and then I find that it's the province in China right next door to Guangdong, which was the province where supposedly SARS came from.
Mm-hmm. So and that's remained pretty...
kind of, you know, PR that they did back then. And I see no evidence that satisfies me that there's been any sort of independent study of this, quote, new virus or new strain that they found where researchers will say, yes, this is really a new virus. All I get is pronouncements from the World Health Organization and the CDC, exactly as in the case with SARS. They already know that there are people all over the world who die from the flu all the time. I mean, they didn't have to, you know, say Fujian flu necessarily to find six people in Colorado that died of the flu or one in Arizona. I mean, you can go anywhere in the world, even, you know, wealthy suburbs, and you can find people who die of lung complications. So I would certainly not succumb to the fear. And I believe that, and my wife, who's a world-class nutritionist, believes that the way to survive well is to build up your immune capability and your basic health as well as you possibly can, as opposed to running around on defense all the time, trying to figure out how you're going to ward off the latest rumor about a new germ. I mean, that to me is a dwindling episode of, you know, you can't win.
And that could be one of the reasons why I've been fortunate enough to fight off the flu all these years.
I would think so. I mean, you stay healthy. So I remember when I was at college, way back in the 50s, it was the, whatever, the Hong Kong flu or the Asian flu. And they told us everybody should get vaccinated, and this was a small college. And I just watched all these people running down to the infirmary, and I thought, I don't need this stuff. I'm healthy. I don't know why I thought that. And I watched while people around me dropped like flies because they were getting their usual colds, and so they automatically assumed it was this flu. I stayed healthy. I never got a shot. I never took any medicine. I just didn't believe it. I mean, I think that there is a huge campaign that goes on year after year after year to keep populations in fear of diseases and to thereby get the latest vaccine, the latest drug, the latest whatever.
How many major pharmaceutical companies are we talking about? And some, if not most, are what, in Europe, aren't they?
Well, a lot of the very big ones are. I would say that we're talking, you know, maybe 20, 25 really super giant companies.
And give me a percent, John, of if 100% of the drugs are out there, what percent of them do you think mankind really needs? That's another one of my curveball questions.
No, I've thought about this one. You know, to me, I think probably 25%? No, 25 drugs.
25 only?
Yeah, that's what I would say, out of the thousands and thousands and thousands of drugs. And the only proviso I would put in that is, again, if it's one of these acute crisis trauma situations where you have to go drug one, drug two, drug three, for 3 or 4 days, okay, he's out of the woods now.
Like an antibiotic or something like that.
Yeah, whatever, you know, and then we got, you know, a few painkillers. You don't really need all that many painkillers, you know, for severe pain. To me, the rest of all of these drugs, and one of my heroes, the late Dr. Robert Mendelsohn, who wrote Confessions of a Medical Heretic,
and, mm-hmm.
you know, he basically said people are being boondoggled into more and more and more and more drugs. I've got a stat here that I have confirmed 17 ways from Sunday that at least 100,000 people in the United States every year die from the correct administration of pharmaceutical drugs.
Now, explain that. 100,000 people die in this country every year by the correct administration. Correct or incorrect?
Correct. Well, in other words, correct administration of approved FDA pharmaceutical drugs in hospitals. Not at home. We're talking about in hospitals. I've got all the citations on my site. I've been posting stories in advance of this interview for about a week now with all the sources of the stats. Journal of the American Medical Association, I mean California Association of Pharmacists. You can find this in, you know, 17 different ways. I mean, this is like clockwork. Every year, bing, bong, bing, bong. 2.1 million people are admitted to hospitals because of adverse reactions to pharmaceutical drugs, on top of the 100,000 deaths. And 36 million adverse reactions to pharmaceuticals, all told, in the United States every year. We're talking about a holocaust here.
Well, it's staggering. It's an epidemic all by itself.
Exactly. I mean, you know, they're talking about, well, we had three deaths in here and two there, so we've got this vast epidemic and everybody should stay home and lock the door. I mean, you know, when I hear that stuff, I mean, I must say I have a pretty thick skin because I know these other figures here. I also know that 550,000 people every year in the United States die of cancer. And I'm sitting here with a bunch of you know, true stories about great medical pioneers in the United States that developed treatments for cancer that were incredibly promising, and they were all shot down completely. And now, and I'm reading statements in front of me from doctors, a couple of which I quoted on my site, that are saying, you know, the majority of people that are dying of these cancers are dying from chemotherapy. So, I mean, what are we talking about here? We're talking about a holocaust that is sweeping across not just the United States, but the whole planet. Behind the idea that we have to medicalize every symptom, every behavior, every move, every thought, every, you know, action of human beings and call it some kind of a disorder or a disease, and we have to treat it with a drug, and that drug turns out to be toxic, because look at these stats here.
Have you ever noticed that when someone, God forbid, comes down with cancer, that the moment they open them up for an operation or to get a biopsy or to remove what they think is the cancerous tissue, the moment they do that and sew them back up, it seems like the cancer races through their body. I've always wondered about what oxygen might do to that, or what the procedure would do in order for that. But it just, to me, John, seems like the whole process speeds up dramatically whenever they open them up. Have you noticed that?
Well, I certainly have heard stories about that, yes. I don't think that anybody dares to, although I'll have to look, publish a study on how that, you know, how often that happens. But certainly when you go tinkering around somewhere and you are not being as careful as, you know, you should be, you can begin to distribute through the body, you know, cancerous cells. I mean, you can help the metastasis along. You can also weaken the patient, because all surgery tends to do that, at least for a short period of time. The patient becomes more fearful and passive when you keep on making ominous sounds about, oh, this could be, we're not sure, and we have to do another test. I mean, I had a friend years ago who, you know, was x-rayed routinely and was told by doctors in Los Angeles that she had breast cancer and needed to have a mastectomy. She freaked out completely. I mean, this was totally unexpected. She was completely healthy. Fortunately, she had a friend in Chicago who was a world-class radiologist, and he said, send me the pictures, and she did. And he got back to her right away, and he said, you know, a few of my friends and I looked at these very carefully, and these are the dirtiest x-rays we've ever seen in our lives.
Mm.
So there's no way to interpret the results here. This looks like somebody, you know, ate his lunch on the film. And my advice to you is do nothing for a year and then find somebody really good. And if you can't, come on out to Chicago and we'll do it right and let you know. And, you know, this is now 20 years later and she's fine.
She's still ticking, huh?
Yeah, but I mean, absolutely. And with cancer, you know, it's sort of like AIDS and it's like a lot of other things. The doctors rely on the patient's fear to get them started on the treatment right away. It's like as soon as a diagnosis is made, the doctor sets the clock, and the clock is ticking. He said, okay, well, now you have to start chemo right away. You have to do this. You have to do that. You have to take AZT, whatever it is. And so the fear factor is jacked up enormously, and the patient becomes usually more passive and says, whatever you say, doc, this is what I'm going to do.
Is it because the doctor doesn't know any better? It's easier for him to prescribe? Or is he part of the game?
He's part of the game, and it's also easier. It works on several levels.
But not every doctor.
Well, every doctor is part of the game to the degree that he honors his education.
Right.
And what he's been taught.
Okay.
And he believes that he is on the cutting edge of what is possible in the field of healing. I mean, that is above all what he believes.
Well, I'm more concerned about the sinister game.
Well, the sinister game, the doctors are simply robot foot soldiers. When you start to now, we go up top to the real motives behind all of it.
And maybe unknowingly doing whatever they're doing?
Oh, yeah. In other words, it's all unknowing at that level.
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, this is an interesting story. I don't know whether we have...
Yeah, you've got some time.
Okay, well, 1992, I'm sitting in my workspace in Hollywood where I was living at the time. And I've got spread out in front of me a whole bunch of research on different pharmaceutical drugs and treatments and their toxicity. And I'm looking at AZT and studies that show that it's killing people here and there, and not just here and there, and chemotherapy. I'm looking at evidence, excellent evidence, that since 1954 in the United States, as a result of the administration of a certain class of psychiatric drug called neuroleptics, 1 million cases of motor brain damage in the United States. 1 million. I'm looking at evidence about arthritis drugs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, 70 to 80,000 people a year hospitalized, 7 to 8,000 people die. I'm looking at all of these stats next to one another. You know, and I'm sitting there sort of in a semi-stupor, thinking to myself, I got two ways to go here. I can say this is all an incredibly serial accident of stupidity committed over and over again. Or I have to say, at some level, this is all intentional. Not at the level of most of the people, 99% of the people who are involved in giving treatments,
mm-hmm,
and even doing research and any of that. They're all just simply moving in this direction that is, you know, is being indicated to them to move in.
Doing the best they think they're doing.
Exactly, and it's very easy to get people to do that. I mean, people don't understand when you say conspiracy, they automatically say, well, you know, this would require 1 million people all intentionally cooperating to do damage, and of course that's not true at all. It just requires a few people setting the parameters of the game and the directions and excluding some of these people that I'm alluding to who have found, say, cancer treatments outside the system. Once you do that and you set the parameters and you've got the money to pay for the people to do what you want them to do, it all begins to unfold and roll out like a carpet. And in this case, we're talking about a death machine and millions of lives damaged or lost completely. And I just decided at that point, and that was about 1993, I said, this is intentional. This cannot be, at the highest level, total serial blundering over and over again with toxicity of drugs. This cannot be that. at the highest level. Somebody wants this to happen.
If we cured diseases, the billion or trillion dollar industry would go away.
Yes. And not only would it go away, but all of the attendant emotion and turmoil around these diseases and the attitudes of people that become hardened over time, you know, what can you do? Life is just the way it is. People get sick and they die. And all of that kind of depression and passivity, and all of that would be wiped off the board, too. I mean, and that's dangerous for the people who want to control everybody else, because now, wow, I mean, can you imagine the emotional lift if indeed all of this disease really began to disappear at a rapid rate?
Yeah,
and
one after the other.
Really telling the truth? I mean, you would have people just, they would no longer be the kind of people who knuckle under to lies and control.
Yeah, what would happen to their population control, John?
Go completely off track.
I want to talk with you about that when we come right back. Population control. I mean, with disease, you have massive deaths. And with massive deaths, you reduce the population. Hey, pretty simple, isn't it? Are they, whoever they may be, inventing diseases just so we would take drugs to treat them? Think about that. Back with John Rappaport in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie, my guest John Rappaport, and of course this is Coast to Coast. We'll talk with John in a second too about population control. John, it's almost a dilemma. Here's an example. I've just got a fast blast message on the computer from Keith in Idaho, and he brings up something I think needs to be addressed, and it explains, I think, where the crux of the problem is. Keith, by the way, has MS, and he says he feels like the drugs over the last 2 years have been helping him with flare-ups, and he believes it's indeed working. And what this brings up to me is two things. One, I think the pharmaceuticals will generally do a pretty good job creating drugs that will help people who have afflictions. The problem is they're not out there curing the afflictions. Instead, they're continuing to produce the drugs to ease the pain a little bit, like in Keith's case, or to reduce flare-ups. But what are they doing really to combat MS? And I think that's one of the big problems here.
It is. Managing it versus curing it or healing it.
Mm-hmm.
Managing it makes a tremendous amount of money for, you know, the industry, just like managing cancer or managing AIDS would do. But, again, I think we now move over into sort of political arena here. What we're really talking about is, at the very least, a level playing field. In other words, if somebody says, look, I have the right to take these drugs because I believe they help me, mm-hmm. and everybody says they will, and I like them, and so I'm going to take them. Terrific. By the same token, however, if somebody who's a health practitioner or a patient decides that the way they want to handle their MS is through a complex protocol of nutrients,
mm-hmm.
then what business does the government have in interceding and saying that this is really committing a crime by claiming that natural substances can cure or prevent or alleviate disease, which is the law? And this is what we're faced with in this country and in many places all over the world. In fact, the noose is drawn tighter and tighter on natural supplements through various international and national bodies here that want to relabel them as drugs.
Yes. As a matter of fact, for years we've been told that the herb echinacea works to build up your immune function and system. And now a study comes out just a couple days ago that they tested children with echinacea, and they said it doesn't work. What they don't say is exactly who did that study and who might have funded it, to the best of my knowledge.
Perhaps. And also they don't say in that study that they did find that the children who took echinacea in that group had a significantly smaller number of colds during that period of time, and they claimed that they didn't really count that because the study wasn't about prevention. It was about what happens to the symptoms once you get them.
Mm-hmm.
So they avoided saying anything about that. But, you know, fine. Okay, so a study comes out, whoever it's funded by, and it says echinacea doesn't work. Okay, terrific. Now, does it cause anybody to really get seriously ill? Absolutely not. So therefore, let's have a level playing field. If Joe Blow over here says, I believe in echinacea, it's terrific, and I want to take it, and in fact, my health practitioner agrees with me, everybody should be quite tolerable about that.
And it's affordable.
It's affordable. You know, Joe has every right to do that. And that's where, you know, this terrific rub comes in, because we really are talking about a cartel attempting to become a complete monopoly here.
Yes.
They want to be able to say, you will take this drug, and if you don't, we can, you know, certify you as incompetent.
And you'll take it at our prices.
Yeah. You'll pay and you'll take it. That's what they want to do, ultimately. That's what the direction that all of this is going in. And they have certain scams and schemes, and there's a number of them that, you know, they use. For example, I know of situations in certain cities in the United States where you've got welfare mothers who are being interviewed by medical personnel who are saying, look, if you want to continue to get welfare payments, you've got this kid of yours who's going to school, and the authorities say that he's got ADHD and he's also depressed. So they're going to give him Ritalin and Prozac. Now, you keep your mouth shut about that. We don't want to hear anything about your complaints about that. Otherwise, we may find a way to cut your welfare off.
And then you find out that most of the kids who have gone into schools and have committed some of these crimes of shooting, most of them have been on some drugs like this.
Yeah, especially the SSRI antidepressants. I wrote a report about that several years ago, and it's posted on a premium content section of my site, where I draw the connections and look at the studies on these drugs. I mean, it's right there in the literature, how these drugs can cause violence and mania and suicide in a certain number of a percentage of the people who take them.
Well, how does the FDA approve all this stuff?
That's a really great question. You know, and why hasn't anybody ever brought the FDA into court on criminal prosecutions? Because, you know, since, I'm going to say, between 1976 and 1985, I was just looking at a citation on a study, about half of all the drugs that were approved during that period of time by the FDA were subsequently taken off the market or seriously relabeled to inform the user of, you know, major adverse reactions.
That they found out later, I guess, or the tests were suppressed and maybe they were never even supplied.
Exactly. This is how it normally happens. For example, the drug companies sponsor all the pre-approval tests on their drugs. You know, they're saying, okay, well, we want to get the FDA to approve our drugs, so we have to carry out certain studies, and these are expensive and they take a long period of time. Okay, fine. We, the pharmaceutical company, are going to pay for that. Now, since we are paying the researchers to do the research, gee, does that sound like a conflict of interest right off the bat? Now, suppose that we test this drug, and I'll give you an example, Xanax, approved for anti-anxiety. What they ended up doing was, I'm going to estimate the figures here, let's say they ran this clinical trial of Xanax for 12 weeks or 24 weeks, and they discovered that over that period of time, the results really didn't differ at all from placebo. You know, maybe even were worse than placebo, but for the first 6 weeks, the drug looked very good. So they use the first 6 weeks of figures, and they submit that as a report on the study to the FDA when the FDA decides whether or not to approve the drug.
And they look great, right?
Looks terrific. In fact, if you look at virtually all of the studies done on drugs before they're marketed to the public, one of the basic criticisms about all of these studies is that they're too short. Because how do you really know what's going to happen if you're talking about a drug for long-term use unless you test it out long-term?
And they don't. They have to rush it. They rush it to marketplace.
So there's the pharmaceutical companies. I mean, and that's just a little bit. I mean, they can put pressure on their own researchers. They can forbid them from saying anything outside of school on bad effects that the drugs might have. They can do all sorts of things. And then the FDA panels that decide whether to approve the drugs are quite often populated with people who have a conflict of interest. They may be a paid consultant to that drug company, or they have stock in that company, or they are a paid consultant to other pharmaceutical companies, and they don't want to become known as the FDA guy who said this drug is no good and I won't approve it. It's a club. It's a revolving door. The people who work for the FDA go out and work for the pharmaceutical companies and vice versa. They come back to the FDA. This is a criminal agency. This is the kind of agency that you would think in a just society, you know, they would prosecute it, they would close the doors, they would fumigate the buildings, and they would find something good to do.
This is the same agency that went after and put in jail Dr. William Reich many years ago. You remember that?
Yes, I do. And in fact, I've watched an FDA trial, basically, of a couple of people. It's very disheartening to see, you know, when they bring somebody in for selling a nutritional, basically a nutritional substance, and say, you're selling this as a drug and we're going to prosecute you. And they bring in federal prosecutors and reams of data. And here's some little guy who was selling something that was helping people, and he is now a cipher, a little tiny figure standing in a storm that is being waged against him by the federal government.
When they should be going after the giants who aren't helping people at all.
Who are killing 100,000 people a year in the United States. And if you look at the
accounting
office...
That may be the third largest killer in this country.
Yeah, and there are some reports that would even go further and say it's the largest. You know, you can look at different studies and come up with different answers, but when I'm giving you the 100,000 figure, I mean, that's a minimum. I've seen a study that says we're talking 800,000, 900,000. So it's big. I mean, and vitamin deaths every year, zero. You know, versus at least 100,000. And who's getting the squeeze put on them? The vitamin companies.
Yep. Oh, absolutely.
You know, you're selling drugs and pretending that they're nutrients. And we have to do something about this. Well, that's an attempt to cut out the competition because, you know, at least half of America is waking up to the fact that they want natural treatments and cures.
In addition to all that, do you also believe that they just don't want cures?
Yes, I do believe that. But we're now going at the highest level again. We're back to population control. And that is at that level. What you just said is absolutely correct. They do not want cures. They do not want it because it ruins their profit picture, but also because they want to control populations, not expand them. They want people dying, ill, incapacitated. They want the turmoil of the emotion of the families and the friends and the coworkers and the colleagues around every single person in this world who is seriously ill and suffering. And we've all been in that situation where either we were the patient or we knew people closely who were, and there is tremendous turmoil in that situation. And think of what that does to this whole planet when we have the pharmaceutical murder of millions of people over time, the deaths, the suffering, the turmoil. That means you've got a population that you can very, very well control. Because people are on a very thin edge. Compare that to a society that is getting healthier all the time with natural means.
Well, you bring up something that I think is very important. The lifespan of Americans has gone up over, let's say, the past 30 years. Would you say that is because of these drugs or because we're smarter?
Two things. I would say both, actually. the drugs keep people in a longer period of debilitation, you know, a sort of semi-stupor.
Mm-hmm.
But getting smarter, absolutely. Prevention, staying healthy.
Eating
finding
right.
Ways to remain healthy, eating better, nutrients, exercise, exploring this incredibly vigorous and vital area of natural medicine and health, which, yes, there are charlatans that abound everywhere, but at the same time, the field is alive with research. And if you are willing to do the research yourself and put in time and find people you can trust, there's gold and then there are hills.
Say the FDA should be spending its time getting the charlatans, getting those crooked companies, going after those people who try to sell tainted meat and things like that with unhygienic conditions. That's what the FDA should be doing.
Absolutely. And this whole area of we approve the drugs, we certify them as safe and effective before they can be foisted on the public, I mean, that agency has failed in that mission over and over and over and over again.
Some cases, the attorneys who rubber-stamped some of the things for the FDA worked for the industries that they were overlooking.
Absolutely. And executives who work for the FDA and researchers came in from the pharmaceutical companies and will eventually go back.
And they go back, probably for more money, John.
Oh, absolutely. Whenever they leave the FDA and go in the corporate sector, they know they're going to be making more money. And they can, you know, enhance their reputations a little bit by coming back to the FDA for a while, and then they go back into the corporate sector.
How big do you think the industry is, the pharmaceutical industry as a whole?
It's
one of the top?
It is absolutely one of the top. It is absolutely gigantic. I mean, think about just, you know, one little random statistic. About 1.3 million people in the United States are getting cancer every year now. And how many of those people are being treated with chemo? I mean, that's just one thing. $320 billion roughly for the heart disease industry. You know, it's just enormous, and it's burgeoning and spiraling in all directions about, you know, the multi-billions of profits and the amount of money that's accruing to these pharmaceutical companies.
Well, here's an example. I think the world of Jerry Lewis, and I think what he does every year to try to raise money to fight muscular dystrophy is commendable. Yet over the years that he has done this, they have raised lots of money, you know, millions and millions. Maybe it's in the billions now in terms of total money that they've raised. What has the hospitals, what has the doctor, what has the researcher done with the money? Because have they found any kind of a cure for even that?
No.
I mean, are they any further along where $1 billion should have shown something dramatic?
And where's the accountability in any other business? You know, somebody, the CEO, would call you in and say, okay, you know, we gave you $1 billion. What do you really have to show for it? And please,
mm-hmm.
spare me the PR.
Right. And where is it? Where's the money? Where did it go?
Where did it go? What did you do with it? And what do you have to show for it? And the answer is nothing, basically. The bottom line is nothing. It's wonderful to want to do something good, but, you know, how long does it take? I know countless stories of people who went down the pharmaceutical road with a disease that they had, one of these, you know, long-term degenerative diseases, and all they got was suffering and pain for their money and time and effort, and they finally said, I've had enough. And they went into natural medicine, and they swam around in those waters for a while, and they found things that really helped them. You know, if they can do that, if an individual can do that on his own, why can't some big-time foundation do that? Why can't the Muscular Dystrophy Foundation all of a sudden say, stop, this is crazy, we've wasted an ungodly amount of money, can't we move next door and let's see what's happening in the natural field? Well, I'll tell you, if they did, there would be such forces arrayed against them it would be like a war, because defections like that are not permitted. And believe me, I know what I'm talking about. Once you are in that game, the way that that foundation is, or any other number of disease foundations, you cannot back out. You cannot say, it's a disaster, we failed to produce a result here, we are now going to explore nutrients in a serious way. You are dead in the water if you do that.
That'll never happen.
Never happen. Never happen in a million years.
They'll continue down the path, they'll continue to raise money, they'll continue to spend it, and still, where's the end in sight?
And then let's suppose that, you know, Dr. So-and-so, who lives in a little town in Montana, presents a little study that he did on his own with 10 consecutive patients who had, you know, muscular dystrophy or MS or whatever over a period of 10 years and said, look, you know, I'm just showing you what I did for these people.
Mm-hmm.
I gave them these vitamins and these minerals and these nutrients and this and that. Here was the protocol, and here were the results. I'm not leaving any patients out, and I'm telling you the truth. You can try this on anybody you want to. Can please somebody listen to me?
And here are the patients, and they're all alive, and they're all doing well. You're absolutely right. How about this quote? If people let government decide what foods they eat and what medicines they take, their bodies will soon be in as sorry a state as the souls of those who live under tyranny. Who said that? Thomas Jefferson said that a long time ago. So I think it's pretty obvious, John, we're establishing here that they don't want to really cure these diseases. They want to just kind of ease the suffering a little bit, ease the pain, and keep us on drugs, keep us suppressed a little bit. They would prefer, of course, that the populations would continue to pass on, because that higher level, which, of course, is that secret society you've written about in the past, they want to reduce the population of the planet. They don't want it to increase. That's probably also one of the reasons why, for example, in Africa, they're not doing anything to help those people out of those horrible conditions out there, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we've touched on that before in other shows, but, you know, the World Health Organization has done probably 15 or 20 task force reports over the years about what's really happening in Africa, and they never act on it. Nothing ever happens. You or I, or any of our listeners here, given, you know, $20, $25 million, could find a few companies within a couple of hours that we could send over there and immediately begin decontaminating the water in a number of those countries. It's, you know, it's not rocket science as to what's really happening over there. And speaking of suppression, one of my favorite stories is the story of Dr. William Koch, spelled K-O-C-H, who in the earlier part of this century, starting around 1919, began to cure people of cancer with a medicine that he invented called glyoxylide. And the original case that he was given in November of 1917 was a woman in St. Mary's Hospital in Detroit who was in end stage of liver cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that Koch, who was then pretty young, was given the case was just so he could treat the woman and then study her body after death, doing an autopsy to see what happened with his medicine. So he gave her a shot of the medicine. He went to come back and see her the following week. The bed was empty. He assumed she died. He continued on. And about 8 months later, on a street in Ann Arbor, Michigan, there she is walking down the street. She comes over to him, throws her arms around him, saying that the people at the hospital told her that he had left the country or joined the army or something. And, you know, he was just
flabbergasted.
He did studies. He treated about 200 patients. He gave, you know, made reports, published reports on what happened. These were serious terminal patients. He gets a visit from the AMA. A man named George Simmons sends a guy down there, Dr. Carstens, who says to him basically, "You're terrific, Dr. Koch. We love you, and we want to take over your research and give us everything you know, and we'll cure everybody." And he says, "Hey, wait a minute. I've got to perfect the medicine. And by the way, I want it so that anybody who can't afford this is given it for free." And then they start to wrangle, and the AMA doctor gets very upset with him and demands that he turns over all of his research. And Koch says, "No, thank you. Goodbye." And from that point on, everything goes downhill. For the rest of his life, it goes downhill. And he eventually leaves the country and goes to Brazil. And I have made a little bit of a research project on this on my own to try to find if there's anybody who still really has that medicine or knows how to make it. But so far, I don't get anything definitely positive about it. But there, you know, it's gone. He was here. He's gone. He cured people. The medicine was incredibly promising. It was suppressed. It was destroyed. And it's gone.
And we have no idea what it was exactly?
Not exactly, no. He believed in the fact that if you could perform certain, you know, that the body stops doing normal oxidative processes in the body, then the body gets ill.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a toxin on top of that in the body gets very ill. And if you can repair those oxidative processes, the body will heal itself and eliminate eventually that root toxin, whatever it is.
By itself.
And so that medicine was a kind of kickstart, and it did that, according to his theory. And it restored the oxidative processes and got them moving again in the body. And no one knows really how it worked.
Was it dramatic, John?
Oh, yeah. I mean, one shot in this woman who was dying of liver cancer, you know, gets up and walks out of the hospital a few days later.
That's dramatic.
I mean, it wasn't always that dramatic, but he was working on people with, you know, I don't want to get too grisly, but I mean, you know, tumors so advanced that they were showing everywhere, and these people got up and they walked away.
He saved them too.
Yeah.
What a shame.
And, you know, nobody knows anything about this guy. Who are you talking about?
Do you think anybody out there practices what he practiced? Are they getting any closer to maybe stumbling across what he might have done?
I've heard rumors, but nothing I can confirm. I do know, however, that in 1948, a senator named Langer read a whole bunch of stuff into the Congressional Record about how Koch's medicines were curing animals, cattle herds in Canada, of all kinds of horrendous diseases, and that American farmers were not allowed to use that. And in that statement that he read into the record, he also talks about a personal case that he knew of a woman who was cured of cancer by Koch after one dose. She recovered. So somebody was using it as late as 48. But, you know, other than that, the family of Koch has a website somewhere. You can find it on the search engine. But, you know, they don't say anything about, yeah, we have the medicine.
Right.
The medicine exists. I don't think it's anywhere.
Uh-huh.
I've talked to people, and they just tell me, you know, we don't know anything about it.
I wonder if it had anything to do with the colloidal silver.
I don't think it did, but, you know, that's just one story. I mean, there's Joseph Gold, M.D.
Edgar Casey. At least his we know about.
Yes. We know that Joseph Gold, who's working at the Syracuse Cancer Institute, developed a medicine called hydrazine sulfate that was curing people of cancer. Not everybody, but it was extremely promising. And this guy was very much in the mainstream.
What'd they do with him?
He was just completely cut out of the puzzle. I mean, his work was completely discredited. There were studies done at the Mayo Clinic where lies were told about the dosage levels. They were supposed to get like 60 milligrams a day, and the doctor was giving him 1 or 2 milligrams, and then some people he was totally over-medicating. Bob Guccione's wife, Kathy Keaton, was a woman who was cured of cancer with hydrazine sulfate, and Guccione began exposing a lot of information about this through a reporter named Jeff Kamen in his Penthouse magazine, and raised quite a storm about this for a while. But then Kathy Keaton got ill, apparently not from cancer, anything relating to that. She went into a New York hospital, had surgery, and died. And people automatically assumed that it was a rebirth of the old cancer, and from what I can tell, it was not at all. Guccione was, I believe, interviewed by Art Bell at one point about this. This is a whole other research line, Joseph Gold. This cancer institute in Syracuse still exists, and they still claim that this is vital and important medicine, and they state that they're still doing research on it. But, you know, try to find it. I can't find it anywhere. Gold was totally discredited and said, you know, the Natural Cancer Institute said that his work was worthless. The American Cancer Society put that medication on its unapproved list, which is like a black list. He's gone.
I had a friend who was working on an expose and had come across an individual who in South America said that the bark of a tree, which was being used as a tea, a medicinal tea by Indians there, and I think he said it was the tabuya tree. Does that make sense?
I don't recognize it, but the story sounds familiar.
And he had a cure, and I don't know what happened to it. It went away. I also believe that on this planet, there may be cures for almost every ailment. I think everything is a yin-yang, John. And, you know, if you got a positive, you got a negative, and vice versa.
Well, you know, there's a lot of research that bears that out. I mean, if you look at the history of suppressed research that we're touching on here only because it's vast, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that if we were playing an honest game here, we would already have at least won the war on cancer and many other diseases by now. But it's all been suppressed. And instead, what we get is, talk about yin-yang, we get destructive medicine that kills people and does not cure these diseases. And so when people talk about, you know, what is really wrong in the world today and what do we need to do, I have to focus in on this very, very tight, because to me, the only single grassroots revolution in the world that I know of in my period of 20 years as a reporter that has made a really significant impact, and I mean from the bottom up grassroots, is the alternative health revolution.
Right.
And you try to find a foundation anywhere in America of any size that has given money to the activists in that revolution, and you will see nothing. This is all bootstrap operation from the ground up. And it's being carried out by people who have awakened to what we're talking about here. And just, they say, you know, mad as hell, not going to take it anymore. That's it. We're going to go another route, and nobody has a right to say that we can't. And that is what has led us to this point that we're at today.
How strong is this lobby to continue to do what they're doing? I mean, can this be changed?
It can be changed, but the only way that I see it changing is by overwhelming public response, not through... There are certain lobbyists that I know, really capable, who have been working the other side of this, which is getting laws passed in various states, for example, that allow alternative treatments and practitioners to use any modality that they want to that is non-toxic. And some laws have been passed in states, and that is a very good, you know, thing. But ultimately, none of this has, you know, works or is possible unless millions and millions of people just stand up and say, you know, we're going to go elsewhere. We're not going to go down the pharmaceutical road. And if that number gets high enough, critical mass, And, you know, there's going to be no stopping it. It may have already reached that critical mass. I don't know, because, I mean, we're talking millions and millions of people that are becoming aware of this whole, at least some part of this whole scam that we're talking about.
Yeah, it's frightening, John.
It is really frightening. It makes you realize that disease is being created as a part of the stage play called Planet Earth in the 20th and 21st century, and that these diseases are really being invented, so to speak, to capture and control and depopulate populations.
And it's been a program that has lasted how long?
You know, I believe that we could go back at least to the Black Plague. Because working by analogy from a lot of more modern diseases mm-hmm. and reading descriptions of this plague, I believe that a great deal of that plague was inflicted on people at the time.
So you're talking about an Illuminati plan?
Yeah, I am.
Pure,
I mean, think of what the Black Plague did for the people who controlled Europe. It derailed all sorts of progress toward freedom for a very long time. And yet there are reports of people who lived out in the country, away from the more urbanized, populated areas, who never got sick at all. It was not inevitable that everybody had to die at all. But it was courted. It was utilized. It was spread. It was promoted, in a sense, at the time by the church, of course. You know, this is God's punishment.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of
mm-hmm.
language was very much the same language as you heard when AIDS came along. And it was very useful. So, yes, I believe it's a very, very long-term secret society-type plan, looking at the planet saying, we want disease, we need disease, it is to our benefit to have it, to have people debilitated and depopulated, and there are many ways that we can make this happen.
How many people do you think die every year worldwide because of incurable diseases?
You mean that could be cured?
That could be cured. What do you think?
I'm going to say
50 million?
200 million?
200 million?
Maybe more, but let's say maybe 200 million. I think it could be higher, but, you know, that's a whole lot of people.
That's 3.5% of the population every year.
That's right.
They keep that up, they might be able to get their goal, huh?
And think about what happens to the other people who don't die, but they just remain in a sort of debilitated state. So you're now making that number a lot higher.
And you're under control, and they're still feeding off of them. They're making money.
I use the image of making the world into a virtual hospital. That's one of the goals of, you know...
Do you think, very quickly, John, we're going to the top of the hour, some of the secret society people get diseases? Or
sure.
Are they all 100% healthy?
No. That they don't understand the whole game that they're involved in themselves. They do get sick. They do get diseases. It's not like they're just completely healthy.
Do you think they take the same drugs?
No. No. I know doctors who don't take the same drugs that they prescribe to patients. So, you know these people, though.
Stay with us. We're going to open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to chat with John Rappaport now, and I'm sure you will. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Lately, I see people going into some of these hyperbaric oxygen chambers, and they're breathing pure oxygen these days, John. Does that help them?
Some of them. I think that is one of the very promising developments, and I guess we'd have to say that that's really on the alternative scene, although it started as something that the Navy used and still does for the bends.
Decompression, wasn't it? Once they came in, yeah.
I had a very interesting interview a couple of years ago with Dr. Paul Hartch of Louisiana State University, who's a neurological researcher down there. And he said to me that he felt that hyperbaric oxygen chambers were definitely a treatment of the future for all sorts of neurological problems, including brain injuries, and that this was all being sorted out, and to him looked extraordinary. And I've had other physicians tell me the same thing. It's not strictly approved for all of these different neurological conditions,
right.
But if you look at some of the alternative activist parent groups involved in autism, for example, they have done an amazing amount of work documenting and reporting on how these chambers help their children who have autism. I myself interviewed a boy some years ago named Ryan, who had been, if not pronounced dead, he was on life support after a swimming pool accident, brain damage. His mother refused to allow them to turn off the machines. She broke down doors doing research and eventually decided hyperbaric oxygen was the thing. The boy had, I don't know, 300 treatments maybe. And I saw him. He was walking. He was talking. He was alive, very much so. And the doctors had, you know, just said, he's going to die, period. So, yeah, I think there are some people out there who are over-enthusiastic about what hyperbaric can do for everybody under all conditions.
And that's just not the case. I wonder if it would help Terry Schiavo in that case.
You know, it's possible. There has been some research done using SPECT scans, brain imagery, before and after hyperbaric that show how some of these cells that appear to have been damaged were not really damaged, and the oxygen kick-started them and they came to life. So there's all sorts of possibilities there.
All right, let's go to the phones. You ready, John?
Yeah, sure.
Let's go east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Coast. You are on with John Rappaport. Hi there.
Hi.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Yes, calling from Columbia, Missouri. Hi, John. Hi, George.
Mm-hmm.
Hi.
Great show. I ironically got interested in this because some years ago, Chris Rock actually brought this to my attention on his HBO special, Bring the Pain. He was joking about it, but had a lot of introspection on why isn't a lot of these things being cured. And I'm just really glad you're on the show. Just wanted to say a few things. I listened to a guy, I don't anymore because of my hours that I keep, but I used to get up at 7 o'clock in the morning and listen to Your Health with Doug Kaufman. Are you familiar with Doug Kaufman, John?
No, I'm not.
He seems to theorized that most of our illnesses, including the great majority of our cancers, is due to fungus and fungi in the air and due to a lot of the things we eat and the molds and such like that. And he has a website called iknowthecause.com. You might want to go on there and check that out. But he was telling on the program how a lot of what you're talking about of how doctors are trained a certain way, and, you know, they don't really know or they don't understand, and if they step out of their so-called boundaries, they're ostracized. And he was talking about a man that was curing people in cancer in days and in weeks, but he had to do it in Mexico because of the laws that inhibit us here in the States.
Yeah, there's a law against curing cancer, right?
Yeah, it's crazy. And he also talks about how our body's like a battery, and it's made up of acid and alkaline, and how if we treat ourselves to a more alkaline diet, and the heavy side of the scale weighs more alkaline, then those people, and you know that they're like that, don't have much cancer. Well, any cancer.
Well, I'll tell you. Here's what I've noticed. There's a very positive side to this alternative health revolution, and it's, like I said, grassroots people. There are groups that are doing incredible work out there. And one of the effects is that more and more patients, when they walk into doctors' offices now, are not simply buying the party line, are not simply knuckling under. They're asking penetrating questions. They want the doctor to explain why he wants to do this, that, or the other thing. They're researching themselves. And this is forcing doctors to not have quite the same arrogant attitude that they're used to using to get away with whatever they get away with. The climate is definitely changing.
I think Chris Rock said during one of his HBO specials, he says, there's never going to be a cure because there's no money in the cure. It's in the medicine.
Right.
And he's right on the money on that.
He is.
Let's go west of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yes.
George, John, this is Kathy from Las Vegas.
Hi, Kathy.
Just real quick, my mother had interstitial pneumonitis. I don't know if you know what that is. It's a lung disease where your lungs fill up with fluid. And she was on prednisone for several years. And then she developed arthritis because it causes different things to go wrong with you.
Yeah, reactions.
And they put her on this Vioxx, which is like Celebrex, which, you know, is supposed to help. And she steadily started going downhill, downhill, downhill. And I said, Mom, what's going on? What have you taken that's different? And I said, it's a Vioxx. I said, go off the Vioxx. She went off the Vioxx. She started to get better, steadily started to get better. And the symptoms went away that were making her worse. But the damage had been done, and I lost her June 28th of 2000. But I think that Vioxx, I don't think, because I read about it later, and it should not be given to people that have any kind of lung problems. And the doctors prescribed that to her.
Why don't they say that, or do they, in their little fine print, John?
No.
Sometimes you'll see it in the extremely fine print that you need a magnifying glass for. But, you know, the process that you're describing here is played out every day thousands and thousands and maybe millions of times, and that is the progressive loading on of drugs for patients, for people who are going the conventional route. They have a problem. They take a drug. The problem gets worse, or it changes into a different problem, and now new drugs are prescribed that create other toxic effects, and so forth and so on, until you get, you know, people who either die or elderly, they're living in nursing homes, and on the night table there are 17 bottles of drugs. And it's gone beyond any potential for sanity. I mean, there isn't a shred of sanity left in the whole process. And nobody would be able to figure out all of the cross reactions and the combinations and the symptoms and the effects. I mean, it's just gone into the total land of insanity.
Have you ever heard what the side effects could be on some of these drugs when you see them on these TV commercials?
Oh, unbelievable.
My gosh, they scare the heck out of you.
Sure.
The possible side effects of this drug is that, you know, your feet will fall off, your nose will fall off. I mean, they just go on and on and on.
That's right. They do. And, you know, people have become so numbed to that they still go to the doctor and they ask for the drug, because the ad always finishes up with a smiling person who says, and I feel so much better now, and I, you know, ask your doctor if blah, blah, blah is right for you. And so people do, and they demand these drugs. And the doctors, more and more doctors are saying that people are coming to their offices saying, I want this drug. Because they've seen it on television now.
Have they not discontinued the practice where doctors who recommended drugs got commissions back? I don't want to use the word kickbacks, but wasn't that happening?
It's still happening. It's a very clandestine area, and I've tried to penetrate it several times over the last 5 years, and, you know, I only catch glimpses of it, but there are definitely payoffs. They may come in different forms. For example, of course, you get trips,
mm-hmm.
vacations, you get...
From the drug companies.
Yeah, you might go to a conference or in the Bahamas, and this happens and that happens. There are all kinds of ways to do this. And every once in a while, you'll see a story about some doctor who's prosecuted or his license is suspended because he was taking some kind of payments. But I think this is much more widespread than anybody imagines. And if somebody, you know, with a real desire to spend a couple of years on this wanted to just concentrate on it, they would find out some incredible things going on.
How about the low-life pharmacist in Kansas City who was finally caught diluting drugs that he was dishing out to his customers? So,
yeah.
You know, if you thought you were taking a certain drug with a certain level of medication, he had the thing diluted 10 times from what you should be taking, assuming they should be taking it, of course.
Yeah, right.
It's a catch-22.
Right. That's right. Well, it's the same thing. You know, they've got developing countries, governments on the hook now to the point where these governments are begging for the drugs. And they're demanding the drugs
mm-hmm.
with all the toxic effects. And they're saying that they're going to go outside the patent laws and they're going to get them manufactured in India and we're going to give these drugs to our people no matter what. And, you know, what are they talking about? They're talking about AZT, for example, a drug that was put on the shelf in 1960 at the National Cancer Institute because it failed to cure leukemia in rats. It's a chemotherapy drug. It's probably the most toxic drug ever released for long-term human use. People who are diagnosed HIV take it around the clock every single day. And if a chemotherapist did that with conventional chemotherapy for a cancer patient, he would probably be sent to prison because, you know, the drugs are admittedly so toxic. But somehow in the case of AZT, this escapes everybody's attention, and these people are medicated to death. And here are countries in Africa demanding that they get lower-cost AZT. I mean, to think of it from the highest level, again, of population control, depopulation, imagine how well this scam is working when you get the very countries you want to depopulate to demand
mm-hmm.
that they get the poison to give to their people.
Unbelievable. Wildcard Line, welcome to Coast. Hi there.
How you doing, George and John?
Hey. We are well.
I love the Doors, by the way. I got the CD.
Well, you know, there's talk that Morrison's really alive. Somebody keeps saying he gets a postcard from him.
Hey, I'm 53 like you are. When's your birthday?
Mine's June 4.
Oh, I'm February. I'm Pisces. Anyway, let me get to the subject.
Yeah, I
was in a mental health facility outside Philadelphia about a month and a half ago. Now, don't tell me how I get in there. I shouldn't have been in there, but I was in there. Everything in that facility, the answer to everything was a drug. You know, you couldn't sleep, they give you a drug. People had a whole load of medication. Now, if you didn't take your medication, you don't get out of there. They write it like the Gestapo.
I'm really glad we got this call because I got a story for you.
Now, I don't want to interrupt you, but there's an anorexic lady in there who I was kind of concerned about. They weren't concerned about her because she wasn't on any drugs. She was, you know, all natural foods and all that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, in fact, I gave her food to keep her, to keep her strength up. They didn't care about her because she wasn't on any drugs, so they didn't really care about her. How you like those and them apples?
Yeah, it's all drugs, as you say.
Right.
A good friend of mine who is an activist in natural health movement was confined to a facility in the East Coast, a psychiatric facility. And again, like you say, you have to take the drugs. You want to get out, you've got to take the drugs. He eventually ended up smuggling into the institution large quantities of vitamins and minerals. He drilled a hole in his mattress in his bed and he hid them there.
Oh, my God.
He took them on the sly because he had already asked if he could, and they said absolutely not. He pretended to take the medication, and after 3 months, he was absolutely fine, and they let him out of there. And, you know, they patted themselves on the back because they said, well, look at what our drugs did. It was so fantastic. This is one of the areas. I mean, we got to understand something here. You go to something called the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is the Bible of all the mental disorders that are put together by committee by the American Psychiatric Association. It is the list of all of the mental so-called diseases and disorders. And what we have to understand is not one of these, and I mean not one of all of these, has ever been proved to have a common biological or chemical root cause In other words, to call them a disease or a disorder is completely off base. They are inventions. They are coagulated inventions made by approximating certain human behaviors and feelings and categorizing these things and saying that they're diseases and they must be treated in these certain ways with these certain drugs, all of which are incredibly toxic. There is no such thing as a mental disease. There are people with problems. There are people who are suffering. There are people who are having trouble with their emotions. There are all kinds of things like that. But that is not the same thing as saying schizophrenia, psychosis, ADHD, clinical depression. And by the numbers, you look at the drugs used to treat these conditions. They are highly, highly, highly toxic. And the whole nation is being led to believe that everybody's got some kind of a mental disorder, and it's not a stigma to come out and say that you've got it and to get the drugs for it. And all of that publicity about mental disorders is pharmaceutically induced so that people will end up taking these drugs.
Well, and you talk about control. You can't get your kids enrolled in school unless you take a religious objection to their vaccination program.
Right, and then once you've done that and gone through all of the, you know, harassment of that, suddenly they now say your kid has ADHD and he must take Ritalin, otherwise we put him in a special class or we deny him the ability to go to school. There is a bill, I'm guessing that it's H.R. 1170, that was passed by the House recently that forbid schools from insisting that kids get psychiatric drugs in order to be, you know, allowed in the classroom or given normal services. The bill has completely stalled in the Senate.
Of course.
And the senators, including guys like Kennedy and so forth, I mean, just will not let this thing get through. It's dead in the water as we speak.
Stay with us, John. We'll be back with you, and we'll wrap up with more of your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. John, your website, of course, you want to direct people to it whenever they need to get to it?
Yes. www.nomorefakenews.com.
Excellent. Let's go back to more calls. They're lining up for you, and the clock is going to be our enemy this time. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. You are on the air. Hi there.
Hey, George. Hello, Mr. Rappaport. This is Mary from San Jose, listening on 560 KSFO.
Hello, Mary.
It's a pleasure to talk to both of you. I just wanted to mention, I noticed that, you know, before when you have an infection, they gave you amoxicillin. It was like $20. Now they have a new and improved version, Augmentin XR, with amoxicillin and clavulanate potassium. That's now, for 10 pills, $125. Unbelievable.
Yeah. 20 was not nearly enough.
No. No, I just wanted to mention that.
Okay.
Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, the squeeze comes, you know, from all different sides. And this is part of what I was talking about before. You jack up the price, so most people begin to say, well, wow, you know, this must be really terrific and powerful, and I'm so teed off that I can't afford it or that it's costing me so much money. But what it basically does is increases the desire for the drug. You know, and I mean, imagine somebody will drive 500 miles to get this drug, a toxic drug, let's say.
They would.
And bring it back, because now they're utterly convinced. I mean, people, you know, say, oh, there's no such thing as mind control. Man, I call that mind control.
It sure is. First-time caller, your turn with John Rappaport. Hi there.
Hello.
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
My name's Gina from Illinois.
Hi, Gina.
Hello. I'm just finishing up a book that was written by Daniel Haley called Politics and Healing. Are you familiar with that book?
It's sitting a foot away from me.
And as I was reading it, I was getting very angry. I don't come from a history in my family of illnesses, so I find myself lucky. But I was reading the book thinking, if I know anybody that gets cancer, I'm going to Tijuana, Mexico, because of the Hoxie Clinic there.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know much about that?
Well, I've read Dan's chapter, and I've seen a couple of films about Hoxie treatment. My basic feeling on all of these methods is that if it were me, you know, I would explore them very carefully and decide, you know, what I thought my chances are. These are all promising treatments. The question becomes, in any individual case, is it going to work right now for this particular person? And that, you know, that's where you really have to make some important decisions. But it's a fantastic book, and it shows the history of these various treatments that have been suppressed.
John, I'm not sure that I would go to Tijuana for medical treatment.
Well, I know there are a number of clinics there. I know a couple of them firsthand and feel that they're very good clinics. But, you know, every person has to make that decision. I know people have gone to Germany, they've gone to Switzerland, they've gone to all kinds of places. It's mainly, you know, who is the doctor, what is he doing, and what do you know about it? And these are not easy questions to answer when you are in the grip of a disease and you have to make a choice.
And you got to make it fast sometimes.
You got to make it fast.
East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Yeah.
This is Pete Zajac from Dearborn Heights, Michigan.
Hey, Pete, how are you?
Yeah, I guess you used to live in Taylor, right?
I used to live in Taylor and in Dearborn Heights.
Wow, that's great.
Matter of fact, I can tell you every street in Dearborn Heights.
Yeah, I live there by Telegraph and Forge Road.
And I was a couple miles south of you near Telegraph and between Van Born and Annapolis.
Yeah, that's part of Dearborn Heights, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, the question is, George, John mentioned hydrazine sulfate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, then that other guy called up and said, also John said the doctor gave it to the lady and cured her.
That was probably glyoxylide, but actually both. Uh-huh.
Well, you understand what copper sulfate hydrate is?
No.
It's root killer. You put it into your roots, in your sewers to kill roots.
Uh-huh.
Now, do you understand that kills fungus? A fungus is a plant. A trees are plants.
Right.
So therefore, a fungus, if it's in a body, kills. If you think of the Bible, they talked about skin diseases. You know, in Leviticus.
Yeah.
And the thing is that I would say that most of the diseases start from the skin. And of course, if it gets bad, it becomes leprosy. But isn't it interesting though that that the guy was you mentioned hydrazine sulfate.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe his theory was. I'm not sure that he had a theory for why it works, but there are some researchers who believe that cancer is parasitic in origin. So maybe.
Do you think any of the vaccinations work?
I think what?
Do you think any of the vaccinations work?
No, I don't. The last thing I would ever do is allow a child of mine to take a vaccine.
How did polio go away?
Polio was already in severe decline.
By itself.
When the vaccine was introduced. And this was part of the fantastic PR of the Infantile Paralysis Foundation was to promote the idea that this was a tremendously expanding disease. And it worked. I mean, I was alive then, and I know that everybody was scared to death. So they assumed that for every case that was reported, there were probably 5,000 cases that you weren't hearing about. But I've seen graphs and descriptions of, you know, death rates from polio, for example. And, you know, it was like a mountain going down, way down at the point at which the vaccine was introduced.
Mm-hmm.
And this is true of virtually all the diseases for which vaccines were introduced. That the rates were already going down. And the reason they were going down was better nutrition, better sanitation, less crowding, the development of a middle class, things like that. A great book on that, if people want to try to find it, is called Medical Nemesis by Ivan Illich.
What about smallpox?
Smallpox, you have a case where I have read reports that the so-called eradication of smallpox in the third world was not nearly as successful as the World Health Organization said it was, number one. And number two, there is always the situation where you suppress the symptoms, the visible symptoms, with a vaccine, and then people get sick in different ways, and you call that something new. In the case of polio, it was meningitis, for example, that the stats for meningitis started going up as the stats from polio went down. And, of course, we know in the third world that as they were saying that they had conquered smallpox, pretty soon they began saying that they saw something called AIDS. And if you begin to add up all of the reasons why people are getting sick in the third world, you definitely have to add into that equation the hundreds of millions of shots of smallpox vaccine. Because if you give those vaccines, particularly to people whose immune systems are already suppressed...
Oh, you're going to kill them.
You're going to kill them.
Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi. I thought it was really interesting, George, that you played Warren Zevon. Did you plan that? Because he just recently died of stroke cancer.
Yeah.
My comment was, have you ever heard of Dr. Brzezinski?
Sure. Brzezinski.
Brzezinski, right. He was in Texas, and he...
Still is.
He has a clinic, but the FDA tried to put him out of business because he has that cure for cancer, pretty much. Or he's been known to alleviate it.
Stan Brzezinski is in Houston.
Right.
His medicine is called anti-neoplastins. He invented the medication himself. He manufactures it himself. This has made him an incredible target.
Right.
Three or four grand juries were convened against him, I think three by the state of Texas and one by the federal government. Prosecutors say that you can indict a ham sandwich, but they couldn't get an indictment against Brzezinski in any of these grand juries because the evidence was so overwhelmingly in favor of the fact that he was successful in some kinds of cancers with some patients. And he continues to practice, but he's under some restrictions from the federal government about who can get treatment from him and under what conditions. He's a hero. He's a genuine, bona fide hero. And this guy has been tireless in running a practice, writing, speaking, manufacturing his medications, fighting off the government, somehow maintaining his equilibrium over the years, and he's there. He's in Houston.
And, you know, of course, the biggest lobbyist in Washington is the pharmaceutical companies with the military, number two. So, you know, we, as the general public in the world, we have to fight against the pharmaceutical companies who want us to take all this stuff.
Absolutely. I'm very heartened by some of the activist groups on the alternative scene, alternative health, alternative medicine, who are unstoppable. I mean, I don't say that very often about activist groups, but I mean, I've met some of these people. I've been part of their groups 10 or 15 years ago, and certain parents groups, for example, and anti-vaccine groups, groups that are against the drugging of kids in schools, against use of heavy psychiatric medications on kids. You can find these people on the internet, and you can work with them. They're genuine heroes. They're amazing, and they are taking it to the medical cartel. I mean, as we speak, this happens every day, and they find ways of spreading the information, of lobbying for some legislation against other legislation, of pointing out the criminal practices. And because of the effects of pharmaceuticals on people in the United States, more and more families are joining up in this battle because they've been affected personally, and they don't want it to happen to anybody else.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, my name is Dirk. I'm calling from Mukilteo, Washington, and I'm listening to you on KVI, and I try to catch your show when I can't sleep, and I'm really, this is really a good one tonight because I was just, well, I've been in the alternative health field for a number of years now, and I've been to Germany several times, and I was just in Germany. I listened to a man, and maybe John has heard of this man, Dr. Heinrich Kramer. And he just came out with a book, and it's in German, and it's very interesting. But he was a director for a large clinic that did experimental drug use drugs on HIV, AIDS, and cancers and other types of illnesses for Hamburg, Berlin, and another large city. But he was there for 8 years, and he wrote this book on AIDS, and it got him into a lot of trouble. He lost his directorship, and ultimately his life was threatened. He had to he has a clinic now in Barcelona, Spain.
This is a guy who was almost destroyed in a car accident?
Yep.
Uh-huh.
And I went there for a number of reasons, but my main reason was to go listen to him, and I was not disappointed because basically I've been seeing people, and it just seems like, and it just breaks my heart, basically, to see these people who come in, and they're just being poisoned to death. And the people that don't do anything, or the people, you know, work with different things, like diet, supplementation, or some of the things that I do, I use oxygen, ozone therapies, and hydrotherapy, who get better and go into remission. And I just want to shout it on the rooftops. You know, we've got to stop. Like you said earlier, it is a holocaust. Only the problem is Hitler treated people better. You know, we are paying for this holocaust. And that's what scares me.
I know what you're talking about. You know, I'll sit here at night and just finish posting some articles and so forth, and my wife walks in the door, Laura Thompson, and, you know, a tremendous nutritionist, and she'll say, guess what happened today? And she'll tell me a story about a patient who, you know, had XYZ and whatever, and how over a period of 2 months what has happened to reverse that. We're talking miracles, you know. And when you hear stories like that, and then you hear the horror stories on the opposite side of the coin, you have some kind of what I would call emotional, mental, spiritual, physical reaction that is very hard to label, but it makes you different. You're never going to be the same again. You now realize something fundamental about the way the world works, and yet also about what's possible if we can throw off this repression, and you're never the same again. That's all I can say.
That's a good point. Let's go to our... Well, we've got time for one more quick call. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah.
I want to talk to y'all about what you've been saying, what you're thinking is going on, and that bark that you were talking about.
Yes.
Paul DiArco. And also, the U bark also kills cancer.
Paul DiArco, huh?
Yeah. And but anyway, this makes me sick, and I've been trying to help with this myself. I'm from a medical family. I grew up in the medical world. And I saw what was going on, and I found out some information, and I've been trying to help people with it. And this makes me sick, just like, you know, you're saying. And one day they're going to answer to God. But anyway, God said he left everything here for us to be healthy, natural. And I believe in natural. I come from an Indian background, and they believed in natural. And it just makes me sick. And, I mean, I've written to people saying, you know, who do y'all think you are? You know, we have a right to be healthy, you know?
Yeah, and that right, you know, can never be taken away if people refuse to let it be taken away, because it's the most fundamental thing. Somebody basically coming into your house and saying, you can't do this, you have to do this for your body. No, absolutely not. You have the right to choose. We all have the right to choose. I could tell you a million more stories about this, but, you know, it comes down to that thing. The mother who's told that she must give her son chemo, who's 3 years old, and she wants to do something else because she knows that this chemo is going to destroy the kid, and somebody's going to say she has no right to choose in that situation? Oh, no. This is going at the most fundamental part of what a human being is, and to tamper and try to toy with that, they are asking for a full-scale revolution, and that's exactly what we're in the middle of right now.
All because of secret societies, John. You know that?
Ultimately, yes.
Thanks, John. Keep in touch. We'll see you on your next assignment, okay?
Thank you, George, so much.
Appreciate it. John Rappaport, nomorefakenews.com, linked up with coasttocoastam.com. Frightening. For Steve Carb, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galante, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Barbara Simpson, Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. I'll chat with Howard Bloom about immortality. Be safe, everyone.